Well, this is the first live presentation I've done since about March of this year. I've done a bit of Zoom presentations, but I think this is the first live one. So it's a very great honor to be here again, and I'm glad to be the first speaker to be in the evening after all this COVID-19 pandemic. And that was not a mispronunciation. Okay. I think it's coming out now that the Chinese deliberately weaponized a virus because they don't want Trump to win for obvious reasons. And I think, by God's grace, it will eventually come out that the Democrats collaborated with them. And if I'm wrong, I'll admit it, but wait and see. God is doing marvelous things in the midst of very great darkness. It's time to have faith and not be afraid. Let's believe God to do mighty and wonderful things. Now, I always like to start out with a little bit of humor, especially after talking about politics. And the Bible says, a merry heart doeth good like a medicine. So I haven't done my biblical puns on Noah's Ark for a while, but I figured I might do that today. What kind of lights did Noah put on the Ark? Well, he used floodlights, of course. Yes. And what bird did Noah use to help him build the ark? What bird? Well, he used the crane, of course. Yes. Okay. And why did God send a special angel to overlook and take care of Noah, his family, and all the animals on the ark? Well, God figured they could use an archangel. And who were the most ornery and obstinate animals aboard Noah's Ark? Well, it was the horses. They're always saying, nay, nay, nay. Okay. And who were the most dangerous animals aboard Noah's Ark? So dangerous that Noah demanded that they both be housed in iron cages. Well, aboard Noah's Ark, the most dangerous animals were the woodpecker and the beaver. Okay. And what two animals aboard Noah's Ark did Noah trust the least? Well, it was the lion and the cheetah, because the lion was always lying and the cheetah was always cheating. So, and why was everybody afraid to play cards aboard Noah's Ark? Well, it's because they were all afraid to cut the deck. Yeah, not very healthy aboard the Ark. Okay. Well, maybe just one more. How did Noah earn the title of being the greatest and most successful stockbroker in the history of the world? Because he was the only man in world history who was able to float his stock, despite the fact that the entire world's assets were in liquidation. Pretty good feat for a man in his day. Okay. Without any further ado, we'll look at the subject today, the nanometric machines of life. These are such tiny microscopic machines that exist within the cells of your body that they cannot even be seen with a high-powered normal optical microscope. They can only be seen by extremely high-power scanning electron microscopes. They are so miniature that they're not measured in millimeters, which is a thousandth of a meter, or micrometers, which is a millionth of a meter, but in nanometers, a billionth of a meter. Those tiny increments are required to measure these fantastic machines. They exist and do amazing things within the cells of our body, and yet, if we could raise them up to normal size, comparable size to our own machines today, we would find that they vastly outperform many of our machines, and they have the fingerprint of God's omniscience and omnipotence all over them. Now, here we have a typical eukaryotic cell. That means it's a cell enclosed by a membrane. It has also an enclosed nucleus and other organelles within the cell that usually also have their own membrane, such as the mitochondria, which are the powerhouses of the cell. The cell is like a manufacturing city, a self-contained city that can build itself, maintain itself, repair itself, and automatically reproduce itself and continue to do that without any outside maintenance or repair for thousands upon thousands of years. We can't even build any machine that can extract energy from the environment by itself, process it, build itself up, maintain itself, repair itself, and wonder of wonders, reproduce itself without any outside maintenance or repair or help at all. Yet even the tiniest living creature a living cell, God has given that amazing ability. With men, this is impossible, but with God, all things are possible. Now, the irony is that with man, the more sophisticated and complex we make machines, the easier it is for them to break down. There's just so many parts that can fail. For example, the most sophisticated stealth fighter in the world today, the F-22 Raptor, for every sortie it flies, it has to stay a minimum of about 12 hours on the ground for inspection, maintenance, and repair. And if they didn't faithfully do that inspection, maintenance, and repair regimen, these things would be falling out of the sky all over the place. Yet God makes things that go on and do all of this by themselves and faithfully do it, even reproducing themselves, for thousands of years. We can't even conceive of making a machine that would run for thousands of years without outside maintenance and repair. But it's commonplace among the masterpieces of engineering that God has put in this world. Now, within the cell, we have all kinds of complex chemical compounds that are put together in amazing and sophisticated ways to form these nanometric machines. One thing you have to have is a cell membrane. That requires lipids. Lipids are fatty acid compounds. And they have to be produced, supposedly by chance, natural laws of chemistry and physics. You also have proteins, which are the structural type of molecules, very complex molecules. They also do catalytic reactions, speeding up chemical reactions necessary in the cell, known as enzymes, catalytic proteins, and also hormones, which regulate processes, tell things what to do and when to do it and how to do it, keep everything regulated and working smoothly. We also have within primarily the nucleus of the cell, DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, which is the information storage and retrieval system that God created. Even Bill Gates says it's far more sophisticated and efficient than any of our best computer information storage and retrieval technology that we possess, even in the 21st century. We would love to have something as amazing as this. And yet, for all of its vast capability and profound complexity, they insist that it happened by chance and natural laws of chemistry and physics. The only problem is that in science, you have to put up or shut up. If you want to say something scientific, you have to prove it by the experimental method. Repeated experimentation and observation proves what's scientific, not somebody's biased, materialistic, anti-God opinion and philosophy. When it comes to proving that we could even get the basic chemical building blocks that then must be put together in this enormously complex system, and this cell is more complex than any machine that man has ever created. In fact, more sophisticated and complex than any machine that man has ever really dared to dream of creating. In fact, just one of the machines within the cell, if you see all these little specks, these little dots, those are ribosomes. They contain 50 complex machines to make a super complex machine that even the evolutionists admit is more complex than any machine man has ever made. That's just one component of this much more complex machine, the single cell. So the myth of the simple cell is just that. It's a myth. When we were ignorant, when we didn't know anything about molecular biology, only within the last half of the 20th century to the present have we began to grasp the extreme complexity of life, even at the molecular level. It is not simple, it never has been simple, and it's infinitely beyond what crude processes of time and chance and natural laws of chemistry and physics could ever do. Now, the evolutionists claim that it's no problem. You look in the major websites of major universities today, you look in their textbooks. If they talk about the origin of the first cell, they always point with pride to the experiment of Stanley Miller. Anybody know what year that was done in? Way back in 1953, many decades ago. It's been about two-thirds of a century. We've had enormous advances in scientific knowledge over the last two-thirds of a century, but we haven't got anywhere past this experiment when it comes to explaining how we could get even the necessary chemical building blocks in adequate quantity and purity to even start to evolve the supposed first living cell. Now, they point to this because they have to have something, you know. I mean, they have to say, well, we got experiments, look at this. But it's making not just a mountain out of a molehill, it's making a galaxy out of a molehill. What he got compared to what they need is so utterly trivial and minuscule. It really is making a galaxy out of a molehill, but they promote it endlessly and say, this proves we don't need God. Just raw energy acting on a chemical environment can produce amino acids, basic building blocks of proteins, and therefore we don't need God. Everything just evolved. Not so quick. That's like saying lightning hit the bank of a river where there was some clay, and it heated that clay and broke it into pieces that look roughly like bricks. They say, oh, natural processes produced some bricks. Therefore, we don't have to have an intelligent engineer or construction workers to build the Empire State Building. It all just happened from this. You might think it needs a little bit more than that. It needs more than just bricks. It needs electrical wires. It needs glass. It needs alabaster. It needs lumber. It needs steel. It needs so many other things. And in this case, getting a few amino acids, you need many, many other things. You have to have the fatty acids for the membrane structure. You have to have the carbohydrates and sugars. You have to have the amino acids for proteins, and you have to have the nucleotides for DNA and RNA. No experiment in the history of the world has ever come close to successfully producing in adequate quantity and purity all those things in a single experiment based on raw energy and natural laws of chemistry and physics. He got what little results he got because he cheated. It was supposed to happen by chance and naturalism. He intelligently intervened. He put a suction device and a trap down here so when these sparks, which were supposed to simulate lightning, caused raw energy to synthesize bonds between the atoms in these atmospheric chemicals to form more complex compounds like amino acids and other things, he immediately sucked them down and trapped them out. He did not allow them to freely circulate through. Why? Because that spark was thousands of times more efficient at destroying the compounds than it was at creating them. So he had to suck them down and trap them out, or he wouldn't even have got a detectable product. Where on the primitive earth do you have a biochemist with his little suction device to isolate things so they don't get destroyed by the same raw energy that created them? That's intelligent interference. That doesn't count. He also restricted ultraviolet light. They claim life evolved on the earth when there was no oxygen. Oxygen is O2. What's ozone? O3. If you don't have O2, you can't have O3. So without ozone, there is no effective filter from the deadly effects of full-strength ultraviolet light, which would kill any living creature that was exposed to it, and is effective enough to wipe out amino acids, nucleotides, etc., in the atmosphere before they could ever reach the ground. But he just excluded that because he knew, if I put it under real conditions, I won't get anything. That's cheating, okay? So what little he got was because he cheated, and he didn't get anything significant. He got a few amino acids. There are hundreds of possible types of amino acids. Only 20 out of those hundreds are correct. The 20 alpha amino acids used in proteins used in living creatures. He only got a few of those, not all 20 of them. He never got any full-blown nucleotides, the building blocks of DNA and RNA. He never successfully synthesized, and nobody ever has, the fatty acids, building blocks of lipids, which are essential for cell membrane structure. So they really even haven't got to base one. You know, if you can't get to base one, you can't run the bases to get to home base, can you? You got to prove that, hey, I can at least make it to base one before anybody believe you can run to home base. They haven't even got to base one. They have never in the history of the world produced an experiment that actually produces all the important building blocks in adequate quantity and purity ever. But they point to this and say, hey, we don't need to believe in God because he got a few amino acids. Well, guess what? This ear is not a garbage can. I tell them, don't stick your garbage in my ear. It's offensive. It's not respectful. You got something intelligent to say, something that's significant with the experiment, I'm all ears. I love science. But don't put this garbage in my ear and tell me I have to believe it when it's pure baloney. Baloney sausage, okay? You have to be careful how you abbreviate bologna sausage. But the good Lord knows that bologna sausage, by any other name, is bologna sausage just the same. There's been a whole lot of bologna sausage flying around when it comes to the origin of the first living cell. Now then, so another big problem is that raw energy can't think. It can't think, I need only certain compounds and not others that are destructive. It just synthesizes them by whatever the laws of chemistry and physics allow as the simplest synthesis. So you end up getting not only the correct type of amino acids, which are left-handed, you get an equal amount of the wrong kind, which are destructive and deadly, right-handed amino acids. You see, we live in a left-handed world when it comes to protein chemistry. We all have proteins with exclusively left-handed amino acids. Like your left and right hands, they are mirror images of each other, but not superimposable. That's why when you try to put a left-hand glove on a right hand, it doesn't fit right. There's a three-dimensional difference. And that three-dimensional mirror image difference makes a whale of a difference biologically. If you have a protein which averages, 300 to 400 amino acids, just one of those amino acids happens to be a wrong right-handed configuration, it jams up the machinery, so to speak. It doesn't have the correct three-dimensional configuration, and it can't cooperate with other nanomachines and systems within the cell. One amino acid, that's a mirror image. It's like throwing a monkey wrench in a gearbox. Everything comes to a stop. So we have to have 100% purity. This is a characteristic of life. Proteins, enzymes have 100% left-handed amino acids. Never a mixture of left and right. Yet raw energy always produces an equal amount because they're both equally probable. It's just happening by probability, you see. So how in the world do we get exclusively left-handed amino acids in all proteins if you have to choose from a mixture of both? Some say, well, it's 1 out of 2, 50-50 probability. You can overcome that. No. If you say that, you're ignorant of probability mathematics. It doesn't work that way. You have to multiply the independent probability of each step in the chain. So it's 1 out of 2 times 1 out of 2 times 1 out of 2 to the power of 300 in the cases of the simplest proteins that we find in prokaryotic cells. Now, another problem is that those amino acids have to be put in a precise order, just like letters of the alphabet have to be put in the right order to spell out meaningful information. For example, this sentence is composed exclusively of the alphabet letters of the English language and makes sense in the English language convention. What do we get in Miller-type experiments? We get stuff like this. 99% of the compounds are non-biological, toxic, lethal chemical compounds that would absolutely destroy the necessary chemical pathways to allow the origin of the first living cell. It's like trying to get life to evolve out of a toxic waste dump. Instead of the primordial soup that supposedly spawned the origin of the first cell, it would be suicide soup. Poison. Oh, we got a few amino acids. You know, here's an A, that's a useful alphabet letter. Here's a T, here's a G, here's an H. But they're just minuscule little pieces within this binding mass of non-biological, toxic, lethal chemical compounds. They never seem to want to talk about that. I bring it up in every university debate I've ever been with. I notice in the rebuttal period, nobody wants to handle that. They don't even want to try to rebut it. Every experiment has had this same problem. Raw energy can't think. It makes whatever chemicals are easy to make, and most of them are non-biological, toxic, lethal, and destructive. You can't have the origin of life from that. How are you going to extricate just the right compounds out of this binding mass and put them together in this precise order like letters in a paragraph? Mathematically, it is impossible, not improbable. It is beyond the number of possible chance events that can take place in all of space and time in this universe and trillions of other universes. There's simply not enough time, not enough space to overcome the type of probability factors we're facing here. Now then, DNA is deoxyribonucleic acid, is the information storage molecule of life, and it's extremely complex and very specific in its structure. It is not life in and of itself, but is a very necessary component of life. And if you're going to have life evolve, you certainly have to have DNA evolve. Problem is, we now know, because of its complexity and specificity, it is literally mathematically impossible that it could be achieved. For one thing, in the structure of deoxyribose sugar, that's the D in DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, that sugar, deoxyribose, can exist in a left or right-handed form. Ironically, in DNA, it has to be all right-handed, no left-handed. In proteins, it's only left-handed amino acids work. In DNA, it's only right-handed deoxyribose sugars work. You get one left-handed sugar in there, again, it destroys the function. It can't cooperate, it can't interface, it doesn't work. So 100% purity is characteristic, not as window dressing, but as absolute required for these to work together the way they're designed and intended to. Now, if we have equal amounts of left and right-handed deoxyribose sugar produced by raw energy, then what's the probability of getting 1,000 of them in a row without a single right-handed one getting in there by accident? Well, it's kind of like flipping pennies. You know, when you flip a penny, you have a 1 out of 2 probability of getting a head versus a tail. What if you have 5 pennies? Then you multiply the independent probability of each flip. 1 out of 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, 5 times, that comes out to be the number 32. So if you had 5 pennies, you throw it up in the air, let them fall on the ground, the odds are that you'd have to do that on the average 32 times before you actually get all 5 heads and not a single tail. But it gets even more difficult if you add more to it. Instead of 5 pennies, let's have 10 pennies. 10 pennies in your hand, throw them up, let them spin around, let them drop on the floor. What are the odds that they'll land with all heads, not a single tail? It's 2 to the power of 10, 2 multiplied by itself 10 times, which happens to be 1,024. So with just 10 pennies in your hand, you'd have to keep throwing them up and let them fall over 1,000 times on the average before you could expect to get all 10 heads, not a single tail. The evolutionists say, fine, we believe we have billions of years. As Carl Sagan said, billions and billions, okay? Well, I don't believe that at all, but even if they did, it's irrelevant. They don't have enough time. Because when you start getting more like this, it goes up on an exponential scale by multiplication, not by addition. And that puts it beyond the threshold of impossibility very quickly. For example, to get all right-handed sugars by chance, 1 out of 2 probabilities, 1 in 2 to the 1,000th power, 2 multiplied by itself 1,000 times is roughly equivalent to the same number multiplied by 10, 10 multiplied by itself 300 times. Actually, the logarithmic conversion shows it's in excess of 10 to the power of 301, but we'll just round it off to be nice to the evolutionists. That number is impossible to overcome. Anybody know the estimated number of atoms in the entire observable universe? All the galaxies, stars, nebula, planets, asteroids, everything. It's approximately 10 to the power of 80. That's the number 1 with 80 zeros after it. This is the number 1 if you wrote it out longhand. That exponent number up there, 300, tells you how many zeros come after the number 1. So in scientific notation, we just say 10 multiplied by itself 300 times. But if you wrote it out longhand, you'd have to write the number 1 with 300 zeros after it. So it's much more compact in scientific notation. But we usually convert to base 10 instead of 2 or any other number because it makes it easier for further logarithmic computations, and that exponent number always tells you right off how many zeros come after the number 1. Now remember, 10 to the 80th power approximate number of atoms in the universe. What's 10 to the 81st power? 10 universes worth of atoms. 10 to the 82nd, 100 universes worth of atoms. 10 to the 83rd, 1,000 universes worth of atoms. By the time you get up to 10 to the 300th, it's completely incomprehensible how big that number is. And it's a number that cannot be overcome, even with trillions of years of struggle using every atom in the universe for trillions of years. So, oops, hit the wrong one there. I'm going to try to get rid of that. There we go. Now, you've heard of a penny for your thoughts. I'm going to give you a box of pennies for your thoughts. A box containing 1,000 pennies, because that's the probability. Take that box of pennies, throw it up in the air, let all the pennies spin around, fall on the ground. What are the odds that they'll land with all heads and not a single tail? 1 in 2 to the 1,000th power, or approximately 10 to the 300th power. Now, can that be overcome? The evolutionists say, oh yes, if you have plenty of time and plenty of attempts. Well, we'll find out you don't have enough time, and you cannot make enough attempts. Not even in trillions of years, not using every atom in the galaxy, you can't even come close to overcoming this number. That's where the fallacy lies. So, we find that 10 to the 2 to the 1,000th power is equivalent to 10 to the 300th power. And get this, there we go. So let's enlist an army of people that will go out and replace every atom in this world, in the solar system, in the Milky Way galaxy, in all the galaxies and stars and planets and nebula, in the entire observable universe. An army of people replacing every atom in the known universe. And these people will all have a box of 1,000 pennies. And they will throw them up in the air, let them fall down, and see if they all land with all heads, not a single tail. If they don't, they gather them up, put them in the box, and throw it up again. And let's say we can speed that process up by time dilation or something, and they can actually do that much faster than normal. Let's say that they can do it at 10 to the 15th power times per second. That's 1,000 trillion times per second, also known as 1 quadrillion times per second, much faster than a natural process could do it. And we'll allow them 10 to the 20th power seconds, 100 quintillion seconds, the approximate number of seconds in 3 trillion years. Now, the evolutionists claim the universe is only supposedly 13.7 billion years old, so giving them 3 trillion years is a very, very generous concession. Surely, they ought to be able to do it. That many people doing that many attempts in every atom of the universe for 3 trillion years, it should easily be overcome. But mathematics tells the truth. It doesn't lie. It's a great friend. I always love mathematics, but friend that never lies to me. Sometimes I don't like what it tells me. You know, I'm working out my balance in my checkbook, and mathematics tells me you're way overbalanced, or you're way over withdrawn. You know, you're in the cold. I don't blame my friend mathematics for telling me that I'm overdrawn on my account. It's just telling me the truth, so I don't get mad at it. The evolutionists get mad at mathematics because it tells them a message they don't want to hear. Their precious theory of evolution is impossible at the very first stage before you can get to base one. You can't get the first living cell. Not even close. You can't even get a DNA molecule, for crying out loud. You need much, much, much more than that for life. And if you can't get to base one, you can't run the bases. You're dead in the water. If you can't get the first species, the first cell, by definition, it cannot evolve into all the other species. So you're dead before you get to first base. That's what mathematics is telling us. I love it in that it tells you the truth. It doesn't lie, unlike many of our politicians. Some lie quite a bit, in my opinion, particularly Democrats, but also Republicans tend to lie. Now, I'm not so jaded as to say that these politicians lie all the time. Some of them are honest and don't lie very much. But a lot of them do, but they don't do it all the time, okay? It's mainly just when their lips are moving, you got to look out, okay? But other than that, once their lips start moving, you got to look out, okay? Anyway, so now we have to multiply all this together. 10 to the 80th power people making 10 to the 15th power attempts for 10 to the 20th power seconds. How many attempts could they make in 3 trillion years? 10 to the 115th power attempts. But we must divide that into the total number of probability possibilities, which is 10 to the 300th. When we divide it in, we find that after 3 trillion years of struggle with an army of people equal to the atoms in the universe doing a quadrillion attempts per second, the odds are still only 1 in 10 to the power of 185. Zero in any operational sense of reality. In fact, the famous French probability mathematician Émile Borel, when he was asked, where would we set the threshold of impossibility for a chance event to take place anywhere in the known universe? He said, for all practical purposes, any event whose probability is less than 1 chance in 10 to the power of 50, you can write it off. It will never happen anywhere in the universe, not even in 15 billion years. This is many, many orders of magnitude beyond that threshold of impossibility. You can't have enough time. You can't make enough attempts to overcome this probability. Therefore, it is not just improbable, it is impossible. Now then, well, I hit the wrong one again, didn't I? There we go. So say we came into the room, here in the sanctuary, and we look on the floor, and up on the floor there's 1,000 pennies. Now, this is not 1,000, and they're not all heads. There's one or two that aren't heads. But say we found an actual 1,000 pennies here on the floor with all heads facing up and not a single tail. And somebody came in and said, wow, look what happened. Somebody spilt some pennies. Isn't it amazing? I would say, you don't know anything about mathematics. That is impossible to happen with trillions of years of quadrillions of attempts happening every second. You can't just say somebody spilt pennies and it happened. That's not reasonable, it's not mathematical, it's not scientific. But I know how it got there. Something we can prove by experiment works every time. What is it? The power of intelligent design and control. And it doesn't even take but a limited intelligence to beat what chance can do. It's so incompetent. You could give those 1,000 pennies to a kindergarten student. Say, please take these pennies, lay them out on the floor with all heads up, not a single tail. And they could do that literally in less than an hour. In a matter of minutes, their limited intellect could achieve something that chance would struggle in vain for trillions of years and not even come close to doing. That's why when we see certain design specifications in life and in things like DNA and proteins and nanometric machines, we know, based on everything that science and mathematics tells us, that did not happen by chance. That is the finger of God. As they said to Pharaoh, you know, we can't do this. That's the finger of God. Well, his finger and his fingerprints are all over his creation. These things had to have been produced by a genius beyond genius and a very much greater intelligence than time and chance and natural laws of chemistry and physics. Now then, oh, my goodness sakes. Okay, so we not only have to get all right-handed sugars, but the correct bonds between the nucleotides. They can bond in two different ways. You get one wrong bond, and guess what? The whole molecule is worthless. It can't cooperate. It can't be used. So that's 1 in 2 to the 1,000th power, or 10 to the 300th power, approximately. We also have to get exclusion of non-biological units. Remember Stanley Miller's experiment? About 99% of what he got was non-biological, toxic, lethal chemical compounds that wouldn't work in any DNA molecule. So the odds are like nearly 100 to 1 that you're going to get the correct one in each space. We'll say it's only 10 to 1. Very generous concession, but even then it makes it 1 in 10 to the 1,000th power to make sure you don't get any wrong chemicals bonded in there by chance. And then we have to get the correct code. like the alphabet letters in the sentence, they have to be in the right order to carry specific information. Get them in a random order, they don't communicate anything meaningful. There are four different alphabet letters, so to speak, adenine, guanine, thymine, and cytosine, ATCG as they're usually abbreviated. They're put together in triplets called codons, and there are 64 different possible triplets with those four different nucleotides. So the genetic alphabet actually is a more complex alphabet than English. We have 26 alphabet letters. DNA has 64 different codons or alphabet letters. And the odds are 1 in 4 to the 1,000th power on that basis alone. But as we can see, it's way, way, way beyond the threshold of impossibility. In layman's language, you'd say, there ain't no way, Jose. In probability mathematics, we would say that this chance event could never transpire because it violates the single law of chance, which states that probabilities whose probabilities are extremely small never occur, and the threshold of impossibility for all practical purposes less than one chance in 10 to the 50th power. So when you're much, much, much beyond that, trillions times trillions of universes with every atom taking place, chance events at quadrillions of times per second, could not come close to overcoming this. It can only be done and proven by experiment to be done by intelligent design. Now, we were looking here at amino acids, the basic building blocks of the structure of proteins. Proteins are, in a very real sense, nanometric machines in their own right. Only 20 alpha amino acids are used. Out of the hundreds that are possible, only these 20. They have to be put together in a long chain called a polymer, and they're chemically composed so they can link head to tail, tail to head, and form these long chains. The specific order of the amino acids carries an encrypted message that tells other nanometric machines in the cell how it's supposed to fold upon itself, kind of like a Gordian knot, and that distinct shape that it makes when it's folded, called the tertiary structure, is absolutely the key to how they function with other machines in the cell. One wrong amino acid in the right wrong place, one left-handed amino acid that's not left-handed but right-handed, one wrong bond, all of that falls apart. 100% purity is required for it to work properly. Well, how did this happen? They say, again, by chance. But here we have Ken Dill, and this was a good episode on YouTube. You can look up The Protein Folding Problem, A Major Conundrum of Science by Ken Dill, doing a TED Talk. And there, he said, protein molecules are a class of machines that do almost everything. They make you walk and talk and think. They run your immune system. They run your brain. They run your heart. They digest your food for you. Got an idea that these tiny little nanomachines are important? They're incredibly important, yet they're way too complex to have evolved by chance. He also said, proteins are machines. These are real machines. That's not a metaphor. They use energy. They spin around. They pump. They act to cause force and motion. They fit all the definitions of true machines, but they exist at the nanometric level. Now, what are enzymes? Enzymes are also proteins, but they are catalytic proteins. They catalyze or speed up essential natural chemical reactions. They have to speed them up many millions, billions, even trillions of times sometimes in order for them to happen fast enough for life processes and life to be possible at all. Without these catalytic proteins, life as we know it would be utterly impossible. What are the odds of getting proteins? Well, in the so-called simpler prokaryotic cells, they only average about 300 amino acids in length. In our cells, they average about 400. So we'll use the lower estimate that they claim evolved first, and we find that to get all left-handed, it's 2 to the 300th power, or approximately 10 to the 90th power. Now, number 10 to the 90th is 10 billion times greater than the number of atoms in the entire known universe. You have to get all correct bonds. There's actually four different ways amino acids can bond, not just two. So it'd be 1 in 4 to the 300th power, which is approximately 10 to the power of 180. You also have to get no wrong compounds included. Remember, Miller experiment shows that's nearly 100 to 1. We're going to say it's only 10 to 1, but we still get a probability of 1 in 10 to the 300th power. And the specific sequence, which is about 1 in 20 to the power of 300, we're going to be nice and say it's only 1 in 10. So we made very generous concessions. But when we multiply these together, what is the probability? We find 1 chance in 10 to the power of 870. We already know what that means. Ain't no way, Jose. Not even in trillions of years, not even trillions of universes participating, you can't come close to getting one enzyme. And they all admit you need a minimum of several hundred proteins and nucleic acids, like DNA, all of them. You know, got to have all that for the minimal life. We can't even get one. Now then, I got the wrong one there. Let's see if we can go back this way. There we go. Research led by Hamilton Smith at the J. Craig Venter Institute in Rockville reveals that the minimum viable genome consists of 387 protein coding and 443 RNA coding genes, total of 430 genes. But those genes are helpless and hopeless and worthless. Even if they all have the correct structure and specificity and are properly coded, they're worthless unless they have hundreds of proteins to work with them. So you also have to have hundreds of proteins as well, for the minimum. To use a very simple analogy, if you have a car that has no gas, you're out in the middle of the desert, 100 miles from the nearest water, you're already dying of thirst, it's no small comfort that you have a perfect car in perfect working condition. It can't do anything without gas. But if your car ran out of gas in the desert, you go and get a gasoline can, you come there and your car is gone. Somebody stole it. You left the keys in the ignition because you figured nobody could drive it away. It was empty. But the person had a gas can with them. They stole your car. Now you're stuck in the middle of the desert with a can of gas, which is worthless because you don't have a car to go with it. That's that way in life. You can't have just one or the other. Everything has to be working together, or it doesn't work at all. Now, an analogy used is that of a lock and key. We have a chemical enzyme, and we have a substrate, a chemical compound that's designed to work with that catalytic protein. And it has to fit into that active site precisely, just like a lock and key. You've probably all had the problem of, you know, having a key copied, and then you take it and it doesn't work. You go back to locksmith, and he looks at it with a magnifying glass. Oh, I see a tiny little burr on this one tooth. Let me file it down a little bit, polish it up. Go ahead and try it again. And then it works. Some tiny little thing was out of tolerance. Well, it's that way with enzymes and substrates, except it's far, far more complex. Because it's not like a thin little flat key. It's like having 10 or more keys put together in a stack, and you have all those teeth. And those 10 keys have to fit in and be precise. And if just one tooth is too long or too short, it doesn't work. It's incredibly complex, not what would ever happen by chance. Now, enzyme expert Dr. Richard Wolfenden of the University of North Carolina showed in 1998 that a reaction, quote, absolutely essential in creating the building blocks of DNA and RNA would take 78 million years in water, which is where it would have to happen, but was speeded up 10 to the 18th power times by an enzyme, a catalytic machine. 10 to the 18th power, by the way, is 1,000 quadrillion or 1 quintillion times. Now then, in 2003, Wolfenden found another enzyme exceeded even this vast rate of enhancement. A phosphatase, which catalyzes the hydrolysis, which means the breakdown of phosphate dianions, magnified the reaction rate by 1,000 times more than even that previous enzyme, 10 to the 21st power times instead of 10 to the 18th, or in other words, 1,000 quintillion times. That is, the phosphatase allows reactions vital for cell signaling and regulation, essential for life, to take place in 1/100 of a second. Without the enzyme, the essential reaction would take 1 trillion years. Imagine waiting 1 trillion years for your food to digest. You'd kind of starve in the middle of time, wouldn't you? More than 70 times even the supposed evolutionary age of the universe, which is only about 14 billion years. Now let's take a closer look at essential molecular machines. One of the most fascinating ones is RNA polymerase. Now, this is a machine that produces RNA, ribonucleic acid. It's color-coded. In real proteins, you don't have this color coding, but it shows you that there are 5 different complex protein machines put together to make this very sophisticated machine. This machine gets a message from the nucleus. Hey, we need more proteins. We're running low, okay? So it goes to the library, the big nucleus, which has the library, contains all the blueprints, information to run the whole cell city, and it tells it you need to produce this certain nanometric machine, this particular protein. So it wraps itself around the DNA. The DNA actually runs through the middle of it, okay? So it's like a shuttle, but the railroad track, so to speak, is running through the middle of it. It's not running on top of it. And it reads that. It has the ability to read the DNA code, those 64 alphabet letters, knows what they mean. It knows where the information starts, where it stops, where to go to, where to find it. It starts at the right place and goes no further and stops. It spreads open the DNA on its inside, and on one side of the DNA helix is where you have the correct order that specifies the blueprint for making a specific protein. So it uses that as a template, and it produces an RNA molecule, ribonucleic. So it's translating it from DNA. DNA is a good information storage language. But to translate it and use it into the language of protein, it takes an intermediate language that's more easy to use, the language of RNA. So it reads it, finds it, translates it into this other language called RNA, and then it goes out to one of these little specks that you find in it. Remember, those specks are called ribosomes, protein factory machines, more complex than anything we've ever made. Now, we find these sometimes floating freely in the thin gel of the cell called cytoplasm. Sometimes they're connected with the rough endoplasmic reticulum. Okay, I'll give you a close-up. They have two major lobes, an upper lobe and a lower lobe. We have the messenger RNA. Now, that's a misprint there. That says NRA. It's not a member of the NRA, although I'm not against that at all. Okay. So the messenger RNA molecule comes from the RNA polymerase. It moves to one of these protein factories, goes in one port, the correct port. It carries the blueprint. Transfer RNA brings in the individual amino acids that form proteins. And this makes sure that it has to follow the blueprint. It never allows a wrong amino acid to get in there. One wrong amino acid could cause a terrible disease, even death. This is not, you know, some minor thing. There's not a lot of wiggle room. So it reads it, makes sure it gets the right ones in there, builds the protein polymer, and it exits the ribosome. Now, the ribosome is incredibly complex. 50 machines put together, 50 proteins put together. Every nook and cranny, every curve, three-dimensionally, has purpose and meaning. It's all dynamically functioning, and it is more complex than any machine we have made. Even the evolutionist R. Garrett, writing The Mechanics of the Ribosome in Nature magazine, the most prestigious science journal in the world, he said the ribosome, together with its accessories, is probably the most sophisticated machine ever made. All of its components are active and moving. Now, once it comes out of the ribosome, it's not free to function just yet. It needs further work. And so there are chaperone nanometric machines that chaperone it and take it where it needs to go. And if it needs some minor folding, the chaperones can do that. But most often they need major folding in just the right three-dimensional configuration. So it goes to these big barrel-shaped nanometric machines called chaperone ends. And how it does it, we don't know. It is astounding. It takes in that protein with hundreds of amino acids. The sequence of that amino acids carries an encrypted message, a code, that tells this machine exactly how to fold it three-dimensionally. One little wrong fold, you have a terrible disease or death. But that code has to be followed. It goes in, it analyzes the code, de-encrypts it, forms it, you know, folds it just right and spits it out. How long? A fraction of a second. That's a big deal, as we shall see. Now then, Ken Dill again says the protein molecule has a code, and the question is how to break it. There's an encrypted message there that tells exactly how the protein is supposed to be folded. If we can break this code and understand it, because it corresponds again to the coding in DNA, it could be the key to finding and destroying genetic disease. All kinds of genetic diseases could be genetically re-engineered and you could be healed. It's an amazing possibility, but it starts with de-encrypting a divine code that God put there and understanding how it works. Now, in breaking a code, it can be hard. De-encryption specialists, you have a hard time, you know, with certain codes. Anybody know what this machine is here, used in World War II by the Germans? The Enigma encryption machine that would automatically encrypt their messages and had so many different mathematical possibilities of what it could be. There was no hope of breaking it, you know, in time to get useful intelligence. A lot of countries gave up on it, said it's uncrackable code. We can never overcome this. But the British were very highly motivated. They were losing so many ships in their convoys due to the German submarine wolf packs, and they knew they were communicating with the wolf packs using the Enigma encryption machine. So they started a top secret project called Ultra at Bletchley Park in England. And Alan Turing, which a movie came out about him a number of years ago, Cumberbatch, I believe, was the fellow who portrayed him, absolute genius. He produced one of the first truly modern-type electronic computers, the great-great-granddaddy, so to speak, of what we have today. And in order to tackle this complex machine and its encryption capability, they had to come up with a far more complex computer. And they had up to four of these at Bletchley Park, and this was key to analyzing the data, finally cracking the German Enigma code, a major breakthrough that helped us win World War II. So in the IBM website here, they say the scientific community considers protein folding one of the most significant, quote, grand challenges, a fundamental problem in science, whose solution can be advanced only by applying high-performance computing technologies. See, they realized with the German code, that was a human made-up code, and it took a computer to help crack it. Now we're dealing with a divine code, a code God put there, much more difficult. And you know what? Our best computers in the turn of the 21st century, around the year 2000, the best supercomputer we had, they estimated, to analyze the code of a single protein and correctly decipher it, they said it would take nearly 500 years, 24/7 computing time, with the best supercomputer we had in the year 2000. That's how hard the divine code is compared to the German Enigma code. So IBM said, we're going to try to do this, it's so important, and they worked for years coming up with a better, faster computer. About the year 2006, they came up with the IBM Blue Gene. It was about 500 times faster than what we had in the year 2000. So instead of taking nearly 500 years, it took little less than 1 year to compute 24/7 and crack the code of a single protein. That's how amazingly complex it is. Well, of course, we have had this problem for a long time. Proteins control almost all cellular processes in the human body, comprising strings of amino acids that are joined like links of a chain. A protein folds into a highly complex three-dimensional shape that determines its function. Any change in the shape dramatically alters the function of a protein, and even the slightest change in the folding process can turn a desirable protein into a disease, and even a fatal disease. So it is very, very complex, very, very important that it be precisely understood. Now, as one IBM researcher had earlier noted, it's absolutely amazing the complexity of the problem and the simplicity with which the body does it every day. Our best supercomputers still can't match the speed that the chaperonin molecules, nanometric machines within your cells, do in a fraction of a second. Reads the code, de-encrypts it, understands it, folds the protein, spits it out in a fraction of a second. Our best computers to this day can't do it that fast. Here we have the IBM Blue Gene supercomputer, and you notice it's not just one supercomputer. An average supercomputer today would be about from the end of this first row here to where this man is standing. That's an average supercomputer. Notice this has row after row, bank after bank, all tied together. And even at that, it took them nearly a year of computing time to figure out the code of one protein. Wow. Now, of course, we do have faster computers. That was back in 2006. But they still can't match this amazing molecule. This color coding shows that it's made up of many different nanometric machines called proteins. We still don't understand how in the world it works. It goes in here, and then it covers a lid over it, and we can't see inside what's happening. But it does all that reading of the code and folding it in a fraction of a second, spits it out, it's done. It looks simple because it happens so fast. Yet our best technology in the 21st century can't even catch up to the speed that is able to de-encrypt the code. So we are getting faster and faster computers, and they estimate that sometime in the decade of the 2020s, we will finally have a supercomputer fast enough that it can look at a protein, analyze it, figure out the correct way it's supposed to be folded based on the amino acid code, and figure it out in a fraction of a second. We haven't got there yet. The amazing chaperonin nanometric machine has been doing it since the beginning of creation, deciphers the encrypted code, and correctly folds the protein in less than 1 second. Our supercomputers will catch up to that, well, we're hoping sometime, but deciphering the encrypted code within 1 second in the year, we're not exactly sure, sometime in the decade of the 2020s. Took a long time for us to get it, and we use huge machines to do what God does with a with the nanometric machine you can't even see with a normal microscope. It's so tiny. God has put us with amazing technology. We truly are fearfully and wonderfully made, and we don't really appreciate it until we compare our technology to the technology of God. Now here we have the Asimo, Japanese Honda walking robot. It's been around for decades. The first versions were really bad. They had no situational awareness. They'd run into chairs, run into tables, run into people, had to be tethered, they'd fall over real easily. Now they have great situational awareness, a lot more intelligent, artificial intelligent computing power. They have cameras that can see and understand, you know. It'll come to a stairway and understand, oh, that's the stairs. It'll walk up it, turn around, and walk back down. They'll even jump over obstacles. Look at it, oh, I can jump over that, jump over it. You can put them on a table and they'll do a backflip, like an Olympic gymnast does off, you know, the balance beam, how they dismount, they jump and land on 2 feet. These can do that now. But they can't come close to doing what God has created in ourselves. We have running robots, two-legged robots that act like the UPS delivery system we have in our cities. You know, they use wheeled trucks. God, from the beginning of creation, designed sprinting robots that sprint at 100 strides per second, carrying a load of proteins more than 10 times their own body weight through the cytoplasm of the cell, which is a thin gel, but it's thicker than water. And it is truly an amazing robot, existing at the nanometric level. It has a long body with a couple of hinges, has a couple of arms up here that attach to the vesicle. The vesicle is like a big sack full of newly produced proteins. And these proteins have to go and be delivered at the right address in the cell where they're needed to be used. These microtubules act as the superhighway system of the cell city. Some of them are fairly permanent. You can't make too many of them, though, or the cell would be too stiff. But sometimes when it needs to go to an unusual address, the cell will not only tell the robot to do it, the cell will create in front of it the microtubule, and it runs along it as it is being created in front of it. Then later it dissolves, because you don't want to have too many of them. It's an amazing coordinated system. But it attaches to this weight of load well more than 10 times its body weight, and it has these two hinges here because it takes off at an incredible sprint of 100 strides per second, like that. You think Usain Bolt sprints fast? He only sprints about 4 strides per second. This does 25 times faster through a gel, carrying a weight more than 10 times its body weight. It's just unbelievably powerful. Now, think about this. I don't know if you've ever gotten into a swimming pool or been in the ocean. Some of these, you go to YouTube, running underwater, type that in. They'll show these guys, they dive down to the bottom of a shallow ocean, pick up a rock to hold them on the bottom, and they try with all their might to sprint. And it's just comical, because water is nearly 800 times denser than air is at sea level. As you have nearly 800 times more mass to try to force your way through, and that really slows you down. These are young, fit guys, but they can't hardly, they look like they're running in slow motion. Just like if you're in a, you've been in a pool, or try to walk to the other side, even in shallow water, you're really slowed down. So imagine Usain Bolt. He runs 4 strides per second, very nearly 28 miles per hour top speed. Yet the Kinesin is the name of these robots, the Kinesin two-legged robots in your bodies that transmit the proteins where they're needed at the addresses in your cell, they run 25 times faster. 25 times 28 miles is very nearly 700 miles an hour, nearly Mach 1. So you could put that, raise it up to the size where the legs of the Kinesin running robot were the same size as Usain Bolt's legs, and they take off in a race, you'd be left in the dust. That thing would be going nearly 700 miles an hour. It'd leave every race car in the dust. And it's doing it, going through a liquid medium thicker than water and hauling a load more than 10 times its body weight. I mean, we just can't imagine the power. We don't have any robot that could conceive of doing that. Yet within yourselves, God put running robots. And if you didn't have them, life would not even be possible. Another amazing thing is that they appear to have some kind of an artificial intelligence involved, because they're running up and down the microtubules. Their feet are designed to stick to it, so they can be underneath it or whatever. They don't have to worry about gravity. And they'll come running the equivalent of 100 miles per hour if they were our size, and yet they detect when another one is coming to get out of the way. They'll never run into each other. We've done weird things like putting a barrier in there, insert a barrier into the cell and cut off a roadblock on the microtubule. And they don't just stop and say, oh, gee, I don't know what to do. It's like they run backwards. They can run backwards and forwards with equal dexterity. It's something we can't do. They run back to the nearest intersection, and they already know, like a cellular GPS. You know, like when you take a wrong turn, and GPS says, okay, recalibrating, all right, turn left at this street, turn right at this street, till they get you back on track, because the GPS knows where you want to go. These somehow know where they want to go, and even if they're blocked, they'll go back to the nearest intersection and automatically take the most efficient route, just like GPS, to get them where they're supposed to go. A form of artificial intelligence. These amazing robots have been there since the beginning of creation, and they are more capable and more amazing than our robots, even in the 21st century. Now, what empowers those robots that they can run 100 strides per second? Each foot attaches to an ATP molecule, adenosine triphosphate. Those molecules are the main energy currency used at the molecular level within our cells. So sugars, carbohydrates is all really mainly used to produce this end product, adenosine triphosphate. And it's produced by a true nanometric machine, only 20 nanometers in length, 10 nanometers in width. Very, very small. These are so tiny that the volume of a head of a pin would contain 10 to the 17th power of these tiny rotary machines. That's 100 quadrillion in the head of a pin. We have hundreds of thousands of them in each cell. In our mitochondria, we have trillions of cells. Okay? 1,000 trillion is a quadrillion. We have many quadrillions of these within our bodies. Each rotation produces 3 ATP molecules. The water wheel down here is spun not by the flow of electrons, the way it is with an electric motor, but by a different positively charged particle. The proton is positively charged, hydrogen ions, positively charged instead of negatively charged like electrons. It's similar to an electric motor in its function, but it has a different charged particle running it. So it's called proton motive force instead of electromotive force. You can spin these things thousands of times per second, but to use an analogy, we'll say the cell city, all of its machines, all of its functions run by gasoline. So every machine needs gasoline, so you gotta have gasoline. These are the refinery machines that convert crude oil, so to speak, ADP, into the refined product, gasoline, so it can be used in the cell. But the refinery machines have to have a power source. That's the Krebs metabolic cycle, which also involves many nanomachines producing the flow that produces ultimately the flow of those positively charged particles to turn the water wheel of the ATP synthase refinery machine, so to speak. So you have to have the powerhouse that provides the energy to run the refinery machines. But wonder of wonders, guess what? Neither the powerhouse nor this will work unless you already have gasoline, so to speak. You got to have crude oil and gasoline. Somebody had already put that there. And then you can supply the powerhouse and the machines to do it. It all works together or it doesn't work at all. How did that just happen by chance when everything has to be there at the same time or nothing works? It can't happen by chance or by natural selection. Now, here we have a cross-section enlarged of the rotary propulsion system of the bacterial flagellum, like E. coli, Escherichia coli. It's a true rotary propulsion system that uses a big flagellum, kind of like a whip, that rotates instead of a propeller, but it has the same effect of propelling it forward. This has been called by Howard Berg of Harvard the most efficient machine known to exist. It's more efficient than any of our internal combustion engines, even our electric engines, which can only get around 70% efficiency. This doesn't do 100%, but it gets closer to 100% than any of our machines do. No machine could do 100% because of the second law of thermodynamics. But this divine machine outperforms anything we have in our technology, even in the 21st century. It can spin rapidly. It spins up to 100,000 RPMs. The twisted propeller, the filament, the flagellum, doesn't twist quite that fast. It appears to have some kind of a reduction gear in there. But it gives them tremendous speed. When there's a single one, it can go something like 10 to 20 body lengths per second. When things are very tiny, we don't measure their velocity in miles per hour, but rather in how many of their own body lengths they can go through in 1 second. For example, a cheetah running at top speed between 65 and 70 miles an hour goes approximately 25 body lengths in 1 second. Okay? We'd measure that in miles per hour, but when they're this small, we measure how many body lengths and then try to compute that with the body lengths that our machines are able to go through in the same amount of time. If you had extra propulsionary rotary machines, you can go even faster. Some have one on each end, so it can go reverse or forward or backward just by turning one or the other one on. Some of them have quite a few of these, and they can go rather fast. They can go up, 70, 80 plus body lengths per second. That's really fast. But we have found one that beats even that. The bacterium that has a special rotary propulsion system that enables it to go underwater, 100 body lengths per second. That may not sound like much, but there's practically nothing in our 21st century technology that can do 100 body lengths per second. Practically nothing. This does it underwater. We don't have anything that could do it underwater with all that resistance. Now, anybody know the nickname for the battleship Missouri? The Mighty Mo, yes, and it is quite a mighty battleship, as turbine engines with tens of thousands of horsepower. But God has his own Mighty Mo. His Mighty Mo is called the MO1 bacterium, and this is the one he has equipped with that special rotary propulsion system so it can go 100 body lengths per second underwater. Now, it does that by having not one, but seven different flagellar propellers, and they're encased in 24 different counter-rotating sprockets or bearings. And that's the key. It keeps it from having too much friction. It keeps them from getting tangled up so that it can spin in unity. It's in the sheath, and you have all seven of them spinning at high speed without too much friction, without getting entangled, and it allows this thing to go 100 body lengths per second underwater, which none of our machines can do, even in the 21st century. So here we have the architecture of a flagellar apparatus in the fast-swimming magnetotactic bacterium NO1. Magnetotactic means it's actually able to use the Earth's magnetic field to help it navigate. Another amazing thing that happened by chance. Anyway, in the cross-section, we can clearly see all 24 bearings and the seven flagellar propellers all embedded. How do they work? They work in a counter-rotating manner so as to minimize friction and to allow no entangling. It is an amazingly complex system. We might copy this in some of our technology and get higher speeds than we have ever done before with true mechanically induced rotary propulsion. Now then, how does that compare to our technology? The fastest submarine in history was actually built by the Russians back in the early 60s, the K-222. It's about 350 feet long. It was able to do nearly 52 miles an hour underwater, which is really amazing. Remember, water is nearly 800 times denser than air. The problem was they didn't do it very often because it often caused damage to the machine going that fast underwater. The MO1 bacterium can go 100 body lengths per second with no apparent damage. Now, if we raise this up more to a size equal to this, it has to be 350 feet long. Let's make it one-tenth that size, 35 feet long. It goes 100 body lengths per second. That's 3,500 feet in 1 second. What does that mean? Excess of Mach 3 underwater. Many of our jets can't do that in the air. Well, here we have a fast-flying jet, the F-22 Raptor. They say it can go about Mach 2.5, 2.5 times the speed of sound. It's about 62 feet long. So 62 times 100, 6,200 feet in 1 second, in excess of Mach 5. This, if it was raised up to be 62 feet long, going 100 body lengths per second, this would be going in excess of Mach 5. This thing can only do Mach 2.5 in the air. This does it underwater. Well, let's try something faster. SR-71 Blackbird, high supersonic, Mach 3.3 times the speed of sound. But it attains that velocity in the upper atmosphere where the air is very thin, very little resistance. In fact, you can see the curvature of the Earth from 80,000 feet where it would normally operate. Mach 3.3, but it's over 100 feet long, 109 feet. So if you made this that long and it went, say it was just 100 feet long, and you have that 100 times that length per second, we're talking 10,000 feet in 1 second. So it would be doing around Mach 9. This only Mach 3.3. Well, let's get a little faster yet. The replacement for the SR-71 Lockheed is working on, Lockheed Martin's SR-72, a scramjet engine. And so it is supposed to go up to Mach 6. It's about 100 feet long. So again, if you made this as long as that, 100 feet, 100 body lengths, 10,000 feet in 1 second, it again would be doing about Mach 9. This can only, even if it works, they haven't proven it works yet, can only do Mach 6. So is there anything in human technology that can go 100 body lengths in 1 second? under any circumstances. Well, yeah, there is one, the Saturn V moon rocket. That was designed to attain escape velocity from the Earth. Anybody know how fast that is? It's approximately 7 miles per second, or in excess of Mach 32, and it's about 25,000 miles per hour. This thing is 383 feet long, and a lot of that is just to get it boosted in the initial stage with all the weight it has. But if we made the MO1 bacterium 363 feet long, and it went 100 body lengths per second, it would also go nearly as fast as the Saturn V rocket at top speed. Not quite as fast, but almost. But you have to remember, the rocket is going through the atmosphere, much thinner than water. And the higher it gets, the less atmosphere it is. It attains its highest velocity in outer space, where there is no atmospheric drag. This thing goes nearly as fast, if we made it as long, going 100 body lengths per second, go nearly as fast as that rocket underwater. Now you take that Saturn V, put it underwater, it ain't going to go anywhere near as fast as it does in outer space. But this thing would. And it's not rocket-powered. It's true mechanically induced rotary propulsion. We have nothing to match it in our technology. Yet they say, oh, look what happened, by chance. There's an old proverb that says, whom the gods would destroy, they first drive insane. The Bible says it a little bit differently. Because they knew God and would not honor God, God turned them over to a reprobate mind, where they no longer think logically and rationally. And for this cause, God sends them a strong delusion, that they might all believe the lie. Who love not the truth, but had their pleasure in unrighteousness. To look at this and say, oh, that's not the hand of God, that's just a bunch of accidents over time, is insane. But you know, people, when they divorce themselves from God, violate the design they were created for. And they really do, in this area, go insane. They're no longer rational. So how did the evolutionists do with it? Nobel Prize winner Francis Crick said biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. No matter how much it outstrips human technology in the 21st century, we can't even start from scratch and make a single cell. Not even today. Yet they say no matter what you see, it wasn't designed, because they hate the designer. As the scripture identifies them in the New Testament, Koine Greek, they are mesotheists, haters of God. And because of their hatred and their bias and their prejudice, they see things we can't even create in the 21st century and say worthless time, chance, blind processes of nature did it? I don't think so. Also, we find it doesn't matter if all the evidence supports intelligent design and contradicts naturalistic evolution. Dr. Scott Dutton, immunologist at Kansas State University, said in Nature magazine, most prestigious science magazine in the world, he said, even if all the data, not just some of the data, or even the majority of the data, even if all the data point to an intelligent designer, such an hypothesis is excluded from science because it's not naturalistic. See, they claim they've rewritten the definition of science from being the search for truth, no matter what that truth may be, to only the search for truth that can be explained by naturalism. If you have to invoke an intelligent creator to make sense of the data, well, that's not scientific because we have ruled that inadmissible. We've rewritten the rule book of science, and God is not allowed. Well, that's not what the classic scientists said. They said we're thinking God's thoughts after him. They have made up a rule to get rid of God by decree. They haven't proved he doesn't exist. They can't. They haven't proved that his handiwork can be produced by naturalism. It can't. In fact, when we look at the experiments, the facts of chemistry, law, mathematics, and physics, it can't happen based on what we do know. But they say, well, we win because we're the only ones eligible. We've written the rule book. You theists are not eligible to compete. The rule book says we're only eligible. Therefore, we show up at the Super Bowl or whatever, we win by default. Because every other team in the world is ineligible. We're the only ones eligible. And we don't have to prove anything. We just have to show up. That's how they've tried to win the scientific argument, by saying God doesn't exist by decree, even though they can't prove it. And I'm thankful that at least some of them even admit that. Richard Lewontin, evolutionist geneticist, he said, but on the contrary, that we are forced by our a priori adherence. In other words, prior to looking at any evidence, we've already made up our minds. Adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations. No matter how counterintuitive, in other words, contrary to common sense, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated, moreover, that materialism is an absolute, a dogma, a religion, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. That's what it's really all about. It's not what you can prove or not by science and experiments and the laws of chemistry, physics, and math. That has nothing to do with that. They hate God. They don't even want his foot in the door. And so they exclude him by a bogus, you know, bigoted, false definition of science that we operate under today, that only naturalism can explain things. Sorry, science has shown naturalism doesn't work. Therefore, there is a possibility that they can't just prove that may be true, and that is there is a creator, whether they like it or not. It's the only thing science supports. Two things we know today make life work, make it tick at the molecular level. One is information, like DNA and RNA. The other is machines. Never in the history of the world have we ever seen information or machines arise by any process of time, chance, natural laws, chemistry, physics, ever. But we could prove any laboratory under controlled conditions any day of the week that it works every time by an intelligent author for information, by an intelligent engineer to produce a machine. It does not happen any other way. If we have to go with real science, they lose every time. So they hide behind a bogus, self-serving, bigoted, biased, prejudiced definition of science that excludes God by definition. And they think that's going to work. We need to tell them, see this ear? It's not a garbage can. Don't stick your garbage in my ear. It's baloney. You insult me. You insult my intelligence. Stop doing that. If you got facts and evidence, experiments, let's see them. I can prove any day of the week intelligence works to get information and machines. Where's your proof it happens any other way? Oh, you don't have any. I see. They lose. So we have to call them on this. This is not legitimate. To exclude God under a bogus, false definition of science. So when we look at the marvels that exist at the nanometric scale within our cells, so tiny you can't see them with an ordinary microscope, you need a high-powered scanning electron microscope to even see these things, we see the fingerprints of God at the tiniest level. From the great cosmos where we see his glory, to the tiniest molecular machines in biology. The heavens declare this glory, his handiworks proclaim his wisdom, and it is inescapable. If you reject it, what does God say? You're without excuse. He said that for thousands of years. Romans 1:20. For ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature and attributes, that is, his eternal power and divinity, have been made intelligible and clearly discernible in and through the things that have been made. His handiworks. Today we've looked at his tiniest handiworks, and we see the unmistakable proof of his wisdom, his power, his fingerprints are there. And those who reject it are utterly without excuse, with no defense or justification. So many people say, oh, I'd believe in your invisible God if he'd come down and do a miracle in front of me. God here is saying, look around, people. By definition, every living creature is a miracle. What's the definition of a miracle? Something that had to originate by a force that was both supernatural, beyond what ordinary forces of nature could do, and also superhuman. Because if human technology could do it, then it's not a miracle. It has to be something that originated both supernaturally and superhumanly, which, by the way, every single creature in nature fits that definition. It could not have happened by natural processes. It cannot be duplicated today. In the 21st century, you can't start from scratch and even put together a single living cell. They are miracles. And God says, stop saying I don't believe. The miracles are there. Today, when the Spirit touches you, do not harden your heart. Listen to the truth and know the Creator who loves you and died for you. That's what it's all about. Science is fun. Science declares the glory of God. But if you don't have a relationship with the Creator, you really have nothing of eternal value. Now, if you don't want to have this available, I have it out there, Nanometric Machines of Life. Tonight, I'm going to be doing a much simpler, this is, I know, college-level stuff here, but tonight we're doing a much simpler, very, very fascinating presentation on my series on biomimicry, copying the supreme wisdom and design found in God's creation and trying to apply it to our own technology. Yeah, very, very interesting, intriguing, so I hope you'll come out tonight for that. But at this time, we'll invite Pastor Jeremy to come forward and close us out. Thank you for your attention.
Let's pray together. Father, may our hearts truly say today how great thou art. As we look at your creation, we just stand back and marvel at all that you make and how that the best of our minds combined can't even come close to what you make in the smallest of your little creations. And things that happen inside our body all the time without us knowing anything is going on. Lord, we stand in awe of you today. We honor you. We marvel that you would make us. And then when we turned away from you in sin, that you would come after us in love, and that you would enter our world, and you would bear our sins so that we might come to live with you, that we might have a relationship with the living God. Lord, may we today stand back in awe of you and glorify you for all that you've done. And Lord, if there are some today who do not know you as their Savior, may they today humble themselves, having considered these truths, and bow the knee before you and say, I want to live for this God. I want this God to be my Savior. May they bow the knee, confess their sin, and place their faith in you. So Lord, have your way in us as we quietly now respond in our hearts to what we've meditated on today. Thank you for this day, for this Lord's Day that we can be together here. Now dismiss us with your blessing, we pray. It's in your name we ask these things. Amen.